This is Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening at 89.5 KPOO here in the Bay Area. You're also listening at www.wps1.org. My special guests today are Jessica Silverman of Silverman Gallery. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just lovely. And Jennifer Rissler, an artist and also the Director of Administrative Affairs, I believe it is, at San Francisco Art
Something
Institute.
Something like that, yeah. Academic programs, but thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So this afternoon, we're going to be talking a little bit about public versus private. We're here, it's a little bit loud, a little bit crazy, at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery, which is graciously hosting this Frank Prattle. And you can get on their website at www.sfacgallery.org. And you can also listen at Frank Prattle at www.frankprattle.com. Maybe you guys can start out with just a brief introduction of who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. My name is Jessica Silverman, and I'm the owner of Silverman Gallery, which is currently based in Dogpatch off of 3rd Street on 20th. And we have a pretty ambitious program where we invite both international curators and emerging artists to do solo exhibitions, where once we invite the emerging artist, we have a sort of hybrid exhibition where the artist and myself talk about his or her heroines or heroes, and we show a sort of mini museum type exhibitions. So.
Sounds good. And yourself, Jennifer, maybe if you give us a brief introduction about who you are and what the hell you do.
Sure. I'm Jennifer Rissler, and I'm the Director of Academic Programs at San Francisco Art Institute, and I'm also a visiting faculty member there. I've been there for over a decade, and my current position, I work with developing the curriculum, expanding the curriculum, hiring faculty, working with department chairs, that type of thing. And I also teach in the undergraduate and graduate programs. And my favorite class is a class called Transmitting Art Practices, which is about the history and theories of fine art education. And I'm also an artist, although that practice has been a little bit on the down low for a while. So.
Sounds good. And if for those of you listening out there, as a heads up, we are located in a fairly busy lobby right now, so there might be people coming up and saying ridiculous things like, where's the bathroom, or which way to the registration desk?
Which we will ignore, politely.
Which I just waved some lady away with, very rude, very bad. My mother would be ashamed. So the topic of conversation today is public versus private, and really how that manifests in different strains in the art world, not only here in San Francisco, but nationally and internationally as well. And maybe we can start out the conversation, Jessica, with you just telling us a little bit about your gallery and how it is that you straddle kind of that line between profit, nonprofit, public versus private, funding-wise, in a gallery setting.
Sure. So Silverman Gallery is a commercial gallery. However, San Francisco is a difficult market to break. In terms of being in San Francisco, I came here for graduate school and hadn't really anticipated to stay, but felt that there was a real need for San Francisco's private art life to be exposed to the public world, i.e. the international art scene, and in a global context. So part of the gallery's mission is to invite artists working in Europe to have shows in San Francisco and to do exchanges with galleries in Europe in San Francisco. So there's an upcoming exhibition where Silverman Gallery will be in Austria and Vienna, and gallery Andreas Huber will come to San Francisco and do a show. So we're really trying to push the boundaries of San Francisco's very kind of private art world into the public sphere, because people out there are curious about what is happening in San Francisco, but there seems to be a lack of exposure for San Francisco artists and galleries.
One critique that I've heard personally about San Francisco and Jennifer, maybe you can chime in on this as well, is that it tends to be a bit provincial as far as the art scene is concerned. I mean, would you agree with that?
To a certain extent, I would, although I think that sometimes San Francisco doesn't get the credit that it deserves. And in speaking to, you know, what I know best in terms of education, the Bay Area has a pretty saturated market in terms of MFAs that are coming out. We have the Art Institute, we have CCA, we have San Francisco State, Berkeley, Stanford, Mills, just to name a few. And I feel like we train and educate the emerging artists in those contexts. And I think in terms of public versus private, I was thinking about this earlier. I think there's a sense that when you're a student, your work is very private. It's just sort of this romanticized notion of an artist in the studio, but that's really not the case. And I think that the Bay Area has fostered this sense of experimentation in the context of its schools. And when you're a student, you're putting your work out there in a very public context within the studio or the seminar, and I think that that's something that's not really thought about. So when students are coming out with their MFAs, they're already armed with the language, the context, the history to go out there and really present their work. And I think we lose those students to other cities like LA and New York, but a lot of those sort of provocations started here in the Bay Area. I think conceptualism, feminist movement, certainly to a large extent, happened not only in the Bay Area, but in California. So I think we don't get some of the credit we deserve.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think it's also interesting. I'm not really sure if you're talking about like the public and private studio life of an artist, but it makes me think about schools like CalArts, which initially initiated a no curator or buyer, dealer, gallery policy to their students because it was really causing problems and rifts in the students' career because they couldn't focus enough on their practice without being picked up immediately for an exhibition or sort of bolted out into the art world. And I think that San Francisco does a really good job and has a really nice reputation for fostering the artist's careers on a long-term level.
As far as SVI is concerned, is it fairly common for galleries to come in and scoop up the, you know, current MFA students?
Oh, it's common not just with SFAI. I mean, there's this whole notion of let's go out and shop for the hot prospects at the MFA exhibitions. I mean, that happens all over the place. Mm-hmm. Not just in San Francisco, but I would say across the board, across the country. But going back to something that Jessica said, I think CalArts probably is representative of the most important, I think, moment in contemporary fine art education when John Baldessari came in 1971 and basically developed the post-studio phenomenon. I mean, I think that really broke it open. And that whole notion of careerism, I think there was a famous phrase that he said, oh, you've got to have your first Whitney, be in the Whitney Biennale by 25 and have your retrospective at 30, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a detriment, that students are learning that while they're still in school. I think it makes sometimes it can make their work more safe. They won't take as many risks because they're looking for that representation.
I had a question for you as well, though, and this is to kind of bring it back into a different context and talk more about your own personal education, and that being before a university or a grad school context, and take it all the way back to your high school experiences and whether or not both of you went to public or private high school. Jessica?
Okay. I grew up in Michigan. And
whereabouts?
I went in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan,
about
30 minutes outside of Detroit.
Okay. All right.
And I was actually supposed to go to public school when I got kicked out of summer camp for something really stupid. And my parents gave me a 3-year punishment, which was private school, where my siblings had been going my whole life. But like I was an artist, and you know, they didn't want to subject me to that until I got kicked out of camp and in trouble, and they thought it would be good for me. And so I went to a college preparatory private school, which really, it was really into sports, and they had an awful art program. I was the only student who went to art school at graduation. Everyone else went to, like, Ivy League schools. And
lonely time.
Yeah, it was. And so as soon as I could get out of Michigan, I went straight to L.A. to art school. And it was, and I never looked back. So.
And Jennifer, yourself?
Well, I never went to art school, but I grew up in Virginia, and I'm a product of public schools. Actually, it was part of the whole desegregation movement, was bused clear across the county as part of that effort. But I think the pivotal moment for me was taking art in high school instead of typewriting, because I figured I could always learn how to type. Why waste my time on that? So,
can you type now?
Sort of.
Without looking at the keys?
No, about half and half. But
good.
So I never studied art per se, but I did go to school for art history and cultural studies, and sort of came through arts administration in the back door, I would say.
But you said you did go to a public school, though, in high school.
Public school.
Okay.
Public high school, public college, private school for graduate school, but that was because they gave me a free ride.
And so as far as, you know, how the youth of today is really educated, because I think it, you know, obviously is the basis for whether or not people go on to, you know, such endeavors as art school or things like that, is to really look at, you know, what foundation we're setting for that. And as far as what you guys are seeing in your, you know, Jessica, your experience in art school, did you hear that most people were coming out of public or private schools, and do you think it matters?
You want to go? I'll answer that. I kind of have, my thoughts are all over the place on that question, because I think we have this No Child Left Behind debacle
God
that is
bless
teaching
America.
That is teaching students to you know, learn by memorizing or rote learning, and so there's absolutely no room for critical thinking. And I think that there's possibly a desire on their behalf when they get to college to sort of break that open. I can say at the Art Institute, I've seen younger and younger students come in, and when I first started there about 11 years ago, the median age was 25, and I think that that was really important, because I think landing in that context where you have to support your ideas and engage with peers, and it's a very sort of sink or swim environment, I think that you had to know what you wanted to do by that point. And so younger students coming in, there's more of this notion of making them feel a part of a community, getting them to have the language down, and it's, I don't know. I would say that there's on one hand a need to sort of know that you're ready for art school, and on the other hand, I think if you're young and open to ideas that you might excel more. It's really a crapshoot.
I mean, do you think that the majority of people that even go to art school end up having professional careers or continuing on the path of art school? I mean, especially in undergrad, because it's my experience that a lot of the people I went to undergrad art school with have disappeared, are not part of the art world at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anybody knows what to do when they're 18. Yeah. And I feel like if you do,
you're a freak.
But I also think that we're getting away from this notion that if you go to a fine art school, you have to be an artist.
Right.
I think that we're looking at, you know, art as thinking, being a practitioner, being you know, somebody who's a cultural producer, and I think that you can go out of art school into many different fields. And so I think we're getting away from that idea that we're going to train you to be an artist, and that's what you're going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that artists now have a lot more outlets in terms of showing their work. For instance, their websites and YouTube. I know a lot of artists now who are being found on YouTube at the start and in the middle of their careers.
And so, I mean, to speak to YouTube, because I think that's a perfect example of, you know, the public versus private, like mm-hmm. something that, you know, oftentimes is one of the most intimate moments, you know, somebody in their bedroom, you know, slightly nefarious bedroom activities going on, you know. Oftentimes by themselves, right? And then you broadcast that to an audience of millions upon millions, the entire world, really.
Yeah. And then you come to art school and learn you can do it in the context of a studio or a seminar, and yeah, everyone loves it. So why would you want to leave, you know? But I don't know. I think it gets back to this issue of sort of the fetishized notion of youth culture. sort of this fetish. I can't say the
fetishization.
Word, thank you, of youth culture. I think that that's really escalated in the last 5 years.
Yeah, sure.
And we see it in the confines of the classroom, certainly in video and performance art. I mean, I think there was a moment at which the Art Institute decided not to have performance courses where the performances were live. They had to be mediated because of sort of pushing the envelope or the boundaries. And I think that this brings us back to a safe space. You know, if you can do it on the internet, it's fair game.
When from your own perspective, Jessica, I mean, you being a gallery owner, have you discovered anyone on the internet?
I wouldn't say discovered. There are artists that, like, I am in conversation with purely because I saw their name on a website and looked at their webpage and asked them to send me a CD so I could have it on file for consideration. And next time I'm in Tunisia or wherever the artist is, I would love to come visit. I don't necessarily just go for it immediately and say, hey, get over here, I'm going to show your work.
Right.
But I'm interested in, you know, the type of work that's out there. And, you know, having a gallery in San Francisco, I can't travel as much as I used to. And so the internet is a really good way for me to research and to see what's out there.
Have you ever seen an artist's resume with links to YouTube?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You have?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, that's how Ryan Treecarden, who's like...
Prattle, my name is...
He's, you know, hotshot. He was found by Sue DeBaer, another artist, and shown to Elizabeth D, and now he's like the rock star.
I think he's Saatchi's boy, yeah.
Oh, he's Saatchi's boy, yeah, for sure. So.
Which, you know, doesn't get much more rock star than that, but... do you think that, I mean, along these lines of YouTube, things like that, mm-hmm. internet technology
Saatchi.
Taking over, you know, Saatchi, iPhones, blah, 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 you know, that that art will ever one day go the way of MySpace with bands? I mean, I know that there are countless, countless bands that I've heard that the first time you say, you know, well, how can I, you know, hear some of your music, they don't give you a CD, they just give you a flyer with a MySpace address on it. Is there something like that in the wings for art? I mean, at SFAI, is that a project you guys are working on?
I think anything's possible. I personally hate MySpace. I went on
do
there.
Do you have a page?
No, well, I think I...
She
actually,
stumbled.
No, I think I do have a page, but there's absolutely nothing on it because I was terrified by what I saw. I went... My friend sent recently got married and said, go check my site, and I had to... actually log in and get a username to view anything. So technically, do I have a page? Yes, but there's the outline of my figure and nothing on it, you know, because I didn't populate it with anything.
Not yet,
because
you mean. Not yet.
Well, I just felt the narcissism killed me. It slayed me, and I couldn't go any further. I wanted nothing to do with MySpace.
Yeah, I mean, I have a MySpace page for the gallery, but that's about as far as it goes.
And?
Smart marketing. You almost have to.
I mean, you really do, especially since when we first opened, we did a lot of live shows and free concerts, so it was really the only way to get the news out there.
So do you guys see that developing, though? I mean, Saatchi, I mean, to speak of the devil himself, has something similar to that where artists upload their work on new sites.
And there's actually an exhibition right now that I just saw in New York at Sara Teshia Roma in Chelsea, and it was curated by... I can't remember the woman's name, but it's a show of Saatchi gallery artists. So basically she went online and found like 7 artists that she liked based on images and research. And they're in this like Chelsea exhibition, one of which is Erica Rockefeller, who's actually a San Francisco artist.
Fantastic. Was the show any good?
It was really good. Eric Doringer is in it, who does these kind of fake Elizabeth Payton pieces, and yeah, it was interesting.
Good. All right, so maybe to continue in a vein, obviously, of public versus private, tell me if you guys get old of that, or, you know, get tired of that, and we can move on to something else. But as far as, to get back to the idea of a public concept of art, right? I spent some time traveling in both Russia and Europe this summer, and they have what's known as a Ministry of Culture, which is this crazy organization, completely unknown in the United States, that its whole business is to fund large-scale government-sponsored projects. And now one may argue that we have the NEA here, which is a, you know, a flagging and gutless beast at best in the United States, and never, you know, promoted to the concept of a Department of State or Department of Transportation or something like that, but always kind of an off-in-the-wings organization. Do you foresee that this idea of public art, like a offshoot of the NEA, could ever blossom into something larger here in the United States? And if so, how would that go about happening? That's a big one. I'm sorry.
I wish it could.
Do you think it'll happen?
It's hard to say. I mean, funding and art support is just so different here than in Europe. And I'm not really sure how one would go about making it better here and making funding for large public sculptures or events more possible.
And I mean, from the stance of a private gallery,
yeah.
Do you ever see government funding or, you know, grants along those lines?
No, not at all, especially for a commercial gallery. I mean, there's very few grants I could ever apply for. My artists can apply for them, but I can't. But I think it would be a really interesting... It would be nice if there was a grant to help commercial galleries invite an artist to do a large-scale work. You know, something that couldn't happen in the gallery. But I've never seen a grant for that.
And Jennifer, yourself, what do you think about that, kind of that split between us and them?
I'm a little cynical, I think, because, you know, San Francisco is a city that won't even allow a peace sign to be, you know, erected in the panhandle as a piece of public art. So what does that say?
So for those of you listening that might not be familiar with this, if you could give a little background information.
Well, just the short story, I would believe, is that there was a commission, artist commission, by Tony Labatt, and he proposed a peace sign in the panhandle. It was this anniversary of the Summer of Love. And I think what was ironic is that the image that he put together was a Photoshop rendered, or it was a digitally rendered image of the peace sign, and it was leaked to the Chronicle, and the Chronicle published it. And it was this real beautiful moment of almost like photorealism, where people thought it was actually... that was actually erected, and there was this huge cry out from the neighborhood thinking that it would be a magnet for druggies and runaway kids. And so anyway, that was this...
Because peace equals drug use, correct?
It was a magnet, right? Yeah. So so they had, I guess, all of these public hearings ensued, and they decided ultimately to can it. And I think the New York Times ran a headline that said, San Francisco won't give peace a chance. And I mean, that's just... But I think when you're talking about public notions of taste, I think it's really a slippery slope to get any kind of federal funding for work that might be perceived by a group as being offensive or quote-unquote not art. But, you know, I also feel like you go to these biennales and we have these massive public sculptures in the forms of, you know, the Audi car because Audi sponsored the exhibit. You know, I'm a little cynical that way about public art.
Do you think there are any branches of public art that are, you know, worthwhile? Perhaps people doing non-physical sculpture, i.e. radio, things like that?
Well, it's definitely a form of public art. I think that, you know, I was looking at these latest sort of rash of museums to adopt, you know, school as a metaphor for sort of public engagement. So I was actually thinking about that earlier today, and Jessica and I had sort of exchanged some emails about this, but... You have the new museum doing night school. You have the United Nations Plaza that came out of the failed Manifesto 6 to sort of try and get the public to be critically engaged, you know, by using seminars and workshops and things that you would associate with schools. But that is a form of public art, and maybe that's the way to go because there's nothing tangible that, you know, is left that could be, you know, disputed.
Yeah, I mean, an artist like Amy Francescini is doing, you know, Victory Gardens around San Francisco. And, I mean, I think that's a really nice gesture, in a way, in a public art. But also, it can be problematic, because if the Victory Garden is put in a place where the people that are meant to care for it don't really have a direct connection to it or feel that it's something that they want to be involved in, that it just basically rots and disappears. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword, you know, with public work in that way.
So, I mean, when considering ideas of public art and you know, kind of some of the faults of public art in the past, and then you look towards the private world of art, which would, I think, probably ideally be characterized by the screaming blonde girls running by us at the point, that you really look at private art, right, mm-hmm. as something probably best epitomized by the art fair right now. You know, like there are, you know, collector galleries, commercial galleries, you know, mm-hmm. such as the one that you run.
Right.
But really the hub of them is the super mall of art, you know, the Armory, you know, Art Basel, things like that. What world, when you look at them, seems to be the lesser of two evils right now? Because I think both tend to be, you know, going in a certain direction that might not be the best for art. As a whole,
the commercial world or the which two
commercial
worlds?
And the public world. I mean, in my own personal opinion, and I'm going to take a stance on this, so I'm not, you know, unbiased. So I don't pretend like I'm not going to sway one way or the other.
What's your stance?
My stance?
Yes.
Is that we need to build bomb shelters again, because the time is coming.
Why don't we start by buying David Ireland's house and build a bomb shelter underneath his house so we can preserve it?
Maybe Andrea Zatel will build a bomb shelter.
But what do you think, though, as far as, you know, the ideas of where art is staying truest? Because many people talk about, you know, not selling out, you know, staying true to the art form, staying true to people. And is it staying true as far as going towards large public projects or more towards the gallery scene? Because there doesn't seem to be any barometer, as far as I can tell.
Well, I mean, in many ways, the gallery world, for me, a gallery is a really important place in my mind. And, of course, I own one, so I believe in it. But in many respects, I feel like it's, you know, disappearing. Art fairs are really where the marketplace is. And so if you're not at a fair, then you're not yielding income, and therefore a lot of galleries I know are closing. You know, so it's kind of like which is the lesser of two evils. I don't really know. The commercial galleries need the art fairs just as much as the art fairs need the commercial galleries. But also now nonprofit galleries are participating in art fairs.
Such as White Columns and things like that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Is that why you modeled your gallery, sort of how you modeled it, and in terms of the structure with sort of the public interface and along with the private representation?
Wait, can you say that again?
Sure.
Sorry, it's
I'm just wondering, is that why you decided to structure your space in a way that sort of spoke to both?
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm very aware of the art market. I worked for a private collection for years before I started the gallery, and really it's important for me to foster careers, and not only in the San Francisco market, but in a global context. And so I would rather spend money doing an art show in Vienna and having their gallery do a show here than go to a fair, because I feel like it's much more rewarding for the people of San Francisco to see what's going on in Vienna, and for my artists that I represent to have an exhibition in Vienna. So, you know, I'm very careful with, you know, the programming in that sense, and definitely aware of the
two
worlds.
You're aware of the audiences too, it seems like, and I think that's one of the problems I have with not just art fairs, but with the sort of the Alanization that's happening. I think a lot of times curators or artistic directors don't take the audiences into account in the cities where they're, you know, most of them are in urban cities, but I think that's a factor that needs to be considered.
Well, I mean, to speak directly to that, San Francisco Art Institute happens to have one of the largest curators in the world right now, Hu Hanru, working for it. And how do you guys balance that with a superstar who does perhaps or perhaps not take into account curating at the Istanbul Biennial? I mean, Has Hanru spent much time in Istanbul? I mean, is he hooked in with the Istanbul community? You know, I mean, questions like that. How would you say?
Well, I think the only way that I can answer that is just what I how I see his experience as a curator manifesting itself in the curriculum. And I think that it provides students, not only MFA students, but certainly students in the exhibition and museum studies program, a chance to see this in action, a chance to ask those questions. Actually, there was one student who was developing her thesis around this idea of audiences in terms of biennales. So I think that's the challenge that we have as educators, is when we bring somebody in, like a Hanru, to make sure that what they're doing is getting into the students in terms of the classroom and the curriculum. And I think it is. And I think that's where, again, sort of those provocations can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's about all the time we have this evening. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Zephyr.
Frank.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're listening at 89.5 FM, KPOO, here in San Francisco, live on the air. Or you're also listening at WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate, at www.wps1.org. Thank you so much to the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery, and their website is www.sfacgallery.com. And you can pick this up on the web at www.frankprattle.com. My two lovely guests tonight have been Jessica Silverman of Silverman Gallery and Jennifer Rissler, an artist who also happens to work at San Francisco Arts Institute. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks.